As I mentioned as we began, this Shabbat is Shabbat Tzedek, a Sabbath of justice and righteousness, and it's used in most instances to commemorate and honor the words and deeds of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Dr. King's birthday is on Sunday. Anyone know how old he would have been? 94 years old, we could imagine that. Had he been. Now, very often, the weekend of MLK, the MLK holiday, occurs near the yard site of a rabbi named Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel, who was one of the leading theologians and thinkers and teachers and activists of the second half of the 20th century. Rabbi Heschel actually was brought over from Nazi Germany here to safety in the United States before the war began by Hebrew Union College, by the Reform Movement Seminary that actually brought over a number of prominent German scholars to save them from what might have been coming then. So Rabbi Heschel actually originally came over to teach Reform rabbinic students, although very quickly he moved over to the Jewish Theological Seminary, the home of conservative Judaism, which is where he spent the rest of his career. Rabbi Heschel's yard site occurred this past week on Wednesday. Actually, it was the 50th anniversary of his passing. Now, these two different folks, Rabbi Heschel and Dr. King, actually were very good friends. Let's put those two photos up on the screen if we could. Right? Dr. Heschel's preeminent work, The Prophets, was tremendously influential to Dr. King. And Dr. King's activism, in which he invited Rabbi Heschel to join him, prompted Rabbi Heschel to declare after the Selma march to Montgomery that he said, "I felt as if my legs were praying." Next slide. We can see that the African-American son of a preacher and the Polish-born descendant of Hasidic rabbis worked together on civil rights, on anti-poverty efforts, standing against the Vietnam War, all of these as models of religious social justice. Now, there are, of course, earlier role models of social justice in Judaism. In fact, this week's Torah portion gives us three possible examples. What's the Torah portion this week? Who's up to date on their Torah this week? Ah, we're hearing from little ringers over here. Go ahead, that's fine. It's right, Parshat Shemot, the beginning of the book of Exodus, right? There's a lot of great stuff in these opening chapters. There's a list of all the Israelites who went down to Egypt. There's the story of Moses's birth, him being placed in the river in the basket, being saved by Pharaoh's daughter. Eventually, he realizes he's an Israelite and he flees the land. He meets the guy who's going to become his father-in-law, Jethro. He marries his wife, Zipporah. He's out in the mountains one day and he comes across this bush that is burning but not being consumed, and he recognizes that he is being called to get sent back to Egypt. Still in this portion, he goes back, he delivers his "Let my people go" speech, all of which we've seen dramatized a couple of times. When I tell you that story, how many of you picture Cecil B. DeMille and the Ten Commandments? How many of you picture DreamWorks and Prince of Egypt? Somewhere between all of that, there's a little bit of Midrash thrown in there, or we rehearse this story each and every year in the Haggadah when we come to Pesach as well. Well, at the beginning of this portion, we meet two women named Shifra and Puah. Raise a hand if you know who Shifra and Puah are. A number of us, that's great, good. Shifra and Puah are midwives to the Israelites. They are midwives to the Israelites. The Hebrew grammar actually is a little unclear whether they are Hebrew midwives, meaning that they themselves are Israelites, or they are midwives to the Israelites. But one way or another, they're notable because you might have noticed over the years that the Bible doesn't usually include unnecessary people, and it certainly doesn't give names to very many women, certainly women who don't matter for something. So what is it that Shifra and Puah do that earn them the honor of actually having names in our portion? Well, here's the story. Pharaoh, it seems, at the beginning of the book, is upset at the number, growing number of Israelites in his territory. This is why he enslaves them. And he calls these two women, Shifra and Puah, the midwives to him. And he says to them, when you go to deliver the Hebrew women of their babies, if it is a boy baby, kill it. And if it is a girl, let her live. This is the launch of Pharaoh's genocidal plan. He commands the midwives to kill the Israelite babies as they are being born, the boys. But our Torah tells us that the midwives did not follow this order from the Pharaoh. Instead, they let the boys live. Pharaoh, when he finds out about this, is furious, and he summons them again, and they tell him, oh, there's nothing we could do about it. These Hebrew women are so vigorous that by the time we arrive, the baby's already born. Whether that's actually true or just what they said, Torah doesn't say, but it certainly hints that this is an act of civil disobedience, that this is the first recorded instance of not following an unjust law. The Torah tells us that God deals well with these two women, establishes households for them. They are engaging in an act of social justice, this civil disobedience, not following an evil command or an unjust law. In his letter from a Birmingham jail, Dr. King wrote, one has a moral responsibility to disobey unjust laws, and any law that degrades human personality is unjust. Dr. King followed in the footsteps of these midwives in this example from our Torah portion in doing what is right. In a 1968 speech, Dr. King said, on some positions, cowardice asks the question, is it safe? Expediency asks the question, is it politic? And vanity comes along and asks the question, is it popular? But conscience, Dr. King wrote, conscience asks the question, is it right? And there comes a time when one must take a position that is neither safe nor politic nor popular, but you must do it because conscience tells you it is right. There's another example of social justice, of doing what is right in our Torah portion, in addition to Shifra and Puah, our midwives, comes from an episode that actually often prompts all kinds of questions. You see, in chapter 2, there's an Israelite woman who places her baby in the basket that goes down the river. Who's that? Who's that? Moses, right? Actually, that's what Pharaoh's daughter names him. We don't actually know what his mother called him before he got the name Moses, but that's okay. Moses is found by Pharaoh's daughter. He's raised in the court. And by chapter 2, verse 11, Moses is still in Pharaoh's court, but he's all grown up. But he realizes he's an Israelite. He's told he's an Israelite. And he goes out to see how his fellow Israelites are faring. He goes out one day and he sees an Egyptian taskmaster beating an Israelite slave. Anybody know, what does Moses do? Right? He rises up and he strikes the Egyptian. He kills the Egyptian taskmaster. In fact, the text seems to say in verse 12, Moses looked this way and that way, and seeing that there was no one, Ein Ish is the Hebrew there, seeing that there was no one, he struck the Egyptian. So we kind of wonder when we read this, is this premeditated? Moses is looking around to make sure that he's not going to be caught doing this. Rabbi Avi Olitsky points to a different understanding, however, of this text, drawing on a passage from Pirkei Avot that says, in a place where there are no people, you must strive to be a person. Bemakom she'ein anashim hishtadel lihiyot ish. Or as Rabbi Olitsky translates it, where there are no menches, you gotta be a mensch. Moses, Rabbi Olitsky posits, wasn't looking around to see if anybody was watching him. Moses was looking around to see if anybody else was gonna stand up to this injustice, to stand up and stop this beating. But Ein Ish, no other person was willing to stand up and do that. There was no other decent human being around willing to take that risk. So Moses himself stands up to be the Ish, to be the mensch. He's looking here and there, not because he's worried about getting caught, because he wants to know, is he in a place, She'ein Anashim, where there are no other menches? And it's then on him to do. This isn't Moses covering his tracks, Rabbi Olitsky says, but rather this is Moses up, standing up to take action when no one else would. Now, we hope when we stand up to take action, when we stand up to be a mensch, it's with the more positive results like Shifra and Pua saving lives than Moses who had to take a life. But the lesson still holds. Where no one is acting like a human being, we must strive to be human. This means being engaged, like Dr. King, in the great issues of our day. It means being engaged in the work of social action and social justice. As I mentioned, Dr. King's contemporary was Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel. Heschel also taught this lesson, both in what he said and in what he did. In a TV interview in 1972, just a couple of months before he died, Rabbi Heschel said this. He said, "Remember that there is a meaning beyond absurdity, and be sure that every little deed counts, that every word has power. Never forget that you can still do your share to redeem the world in spite of all of the absurdities and frustrations and disappointments." I think Heschel is teaching that every deed we do, every word we say can make a difference. And that means that if we don't stand up and we don't speak up and we don't get engaged, then that difference doesn't get made. What we do matters in making our world a better place. This message is not a new one or strange or foreign to us. It's very familiar. Reform Judaism has long seen itself as proud proponents of our prophetic tradition. Reform congregations have always been involved in the work of social action and social justice. Think about what we do here at our congregation, just to name a few things. Our collections for LCAC, our engagement with Afghan families through RAFT, taking collections for them and teaching English as a second language. Our high holiday food drive, which filled an entire truck and restocked the shelves at LCAC. Beastie, a couple of months ago before Hanukkah, collecting winter coats. Our civic engagement project, writing postcards to folks, encouraging them to register to vote. Our educational efforts, raising awareness around important legislative issues. Our discussion of racial justice, of reproductive rights, of Israel. Every one of our Bar Bat Mitzvah students does a mitzvah project that makes a difference in the world. We'll look ahead in a couple of months in April to our Yom Chesed, a full congregation all-day mitzvah day for us, and so much more. Many of us, most of us, all of us here, have taken to heart already the teachings of Dr. King and Rabbi Heschel. We've made them important parts of our participation in the life of this sacred community. I like to quote the person who said, "Coincidence is just God's way of remaining anonymous." It's no coincidence, I believe, that Rabbi Heschel's yard site this week is so close to the MLK holiday. And it's no surprise that these two exemplars of religiously motivated social justice work inspired each other, supported each other, and were truly good friends. They both knew their biblical stories. They recognized in Shifra and in Pua the audacity to disobey a pharaoh in an act that they describe as civil disobedience. And they recognized in Moses the willingness to stand up for what was right, even when no one else would do so. From the lessons of our Torah portion this week, from the examples of the lives of these two great individuals on this social action Shabbat, on this Shabbat Tzedek, let us remember our responsibility to challenge injustice. Let us be inspired to stand up for what is right. Let us continue to make our world a place of God's blessings. And let us all say, Amen.